As a youngster, I grew up in the Exclusive Brethren. We were 12 when we were excommunicated, which in retrospect was one of the most wonderful things that God ever did for us. But the result of that was that we spent 8 years then wandering in the theological wilderness, trying to find our moorings again, and it was a difficult time, particularly for my parents, as they tried to sort through what was truly biblical and what was just something they'd inherited from the past. In my early 20s, we found our way back into a conservative evangelical assembly in Melbourne, which is a great blessing. But there was a question that started to emerge for me in my early 20s that troubled me. And that question was, why, as we claim to be biblical, I mean, the reason I'm in the assembly today is because I really do believe that we operate as closely to the New Testament principles and models as any other denomination does, and so that's where I want to be. But the question that troubled me was, why, if we claim to be biblical, as I look around me, why aren't we growing? I was in a small assembly, a lot going for it, but I was watching it over a period of years really struggle to maintain the status quo, let alone to go forward. Why, I was asking myself, with our commitment to biblical principles and the patterns and models that we find in the New Testament, aren't we seeing at least a small degree of significant growth? It was partly in quest of an answer to that question that in 86, 87, my wife and I went to the US and we spent 9 months doing the discipleship intern training program at Fairhaven Bible Chapel under Jean Gibson and Bill McDonald. That gave me some answers and also some additional insights into the way God had shaped me and some direction for when we returned to Melbourne. And consequently, when we returned there, I spent a year in our old assembly before moving to a church plant that had been established on the fringes of Melbourne. In the midst of all that, I completed a BTH at three of the major evangelical colleges in Melbourne. And then at the end of that time, we moved here to Sydney. The last 3 years have taken me into assemblies across all the various states in this country apart from WA. We just can't seem to get there because of the distance. And what I want to share with you tonight is particularly some research that has come out of that three-year period as we've really struggled to ask ourselves, where is the assembly movement going and what is its future? Now, just as I begin that process for you, talking about the origin and growth of the Brethren in Australia, let me just ask you a question that I'm surprised that many of us don't know the answer to, but do any of you know when the first Brethren Assembly was established in Australia? About 1870? Newtown area of Sydney? Well, you might find Ken Newton disagrees with you a little bit on that. He would argue that Melbourne was was the home of the first assembly in around 1850. Yeah, that's right. We'll never know. But generally it's held that the first assembly was established around the 1850s. There's a certain amount of cloudiness attached to that, but that's around about the period of which we're talking, around the 1850s. Now, the number of assemblies multiplied rapidly until around the turn of the century, around the 1900s, there were about 50 assemblies in this country that we're aware of. Then, through the first half of the 1900s, the assemblies continued to multiply rather rapidly until around 1950, we had about 230 assemblies listed in AMC. There was more, obviously, because we all know that not every assembly lists in AMC. That's what we're aware of, around about 230. Then came the 1960s when much of the world as we knew it began to change and change rapidly. Any of you that study history, even remotely, will know that the 1960s has marked a significant turning point in history, in modern history. It marked the beginning of some phenomenal changes that we are still struggling to cope with today and come to terms with, and it's reached across all areas of human experience. Let me give you seven of those major changes because they really set us up to where we want to go beyond this. The first one has been the area of the change in terms of technology. The invention of the microchip irreversibly changed life as we know it, and it's impacting our lives extraordinarily. It moved us from an industrial to a technological age, and now it's moving us into what they call the information age, with all the changes that will be forced upon us as a result of that. The speed of change has been phenomenal, and it's changed life dramatically. Is a somewhat humorous illustration of that, or I was reminded of that by an older friend in one of the assemblies recently, and he'd just taken delivery of a new air conditioner, and he was rather bemusedly looking at the remote control that came with his air conditioner, trying to work it out to turn his air conditioner on with this remote control, And he said to me, you know, he said, I reckon a young person can make a career out of moving around telling old people how to drive their air conditioner. But, I mean, we laugh at that, but that's really, the world we're living in is changing so rapidly that many of us are struggling to cope with the changes that are coming. So that's the first area that's been significant in terms of change since the 60s, and that of technology. The second is that of materialism. Since the 60s, materialism has become rampant, particularly in the West, and that's created often unnecessary expectations as to what our real needs are. And that has driven many mums back into the workforce with all the changes that has brought to families, etc. The third thing that I want to note is that of urbanisation of the pool to city life. And if you have, any of you have anything to do with some of the country assemblies and the country churches, you know all sorts of, you know, all the pressures that's been brought to bear on those little country churches as they struggle to cope with their young people being dragged to the city just simply in quest of a job. And that's created all sorts of pressures for them. The fourth one that, has been a significant point of change since the 60s has been in the area of sport and recreation. Sport, which was previously relegated to Saturdays, is now, and now competes with the church and all other activities alike for allegiance on Sunday, both the Christian and non-Christian allegiance. Being from Melbourne, the football game that I follow is AFL, and I'm still struggling to come to terms with rugby. One day I might do that if I stay here long enough. But I can remember when the first Sunday game was introduced into Melbourne by the AFL. And the representatives of the AFL had made that announcement, assured us that there would only be three games played on a Sunday, and for the foreseeable future that's how it would remain. I was looking at the draw, I think, for last year, and I think there was more games played on Sunday than there were on Saturday. And that's what's happening in the world we're living in now, where sport is becoming such a powerful influence on Sunday that it's really competing with the church for non-Christian and Christian allegiance. The other area that's been significant since the 60s has been the advent of television with its enormous influence over our time and our thinking. It's a huge area that we really need to think through, and it's had a massive impact on the church, and I'll come back to that a little. The sixth thing that I've noticed is that of the increased leisure activities. You know, the variety and options for our children today are immense, and the car truly is becoming mum's taxi. I mean, we laugh when we see that little sticker on the back of it. But for a lot of mums, that's reality. That's what the car has become, as they cart their kids around from activity to activity over weeknight and over the weekend. Just that huge variety of entertainment that our kids are exposed to now creates enormous demands on their time and drags them away, in a sense, from the church. And the seventh that I really wanted to note, and is more obviously, is that of the emphasis that is being placed today upon more extensive and intense education for our kids. And I think we need to think through this carefully, but from a Christian perspective, so often we're imparting, I think whether we realise it or not, to our children that education is so important that they've got to pursue it with all their heart and mind and soul, and they often get out of secondary education and tertiary education without having spent a great deal of time in the scriptures, simply because as parents we've been telling them they've got to get a good education in order to get a good job. And see, what that does, often that emphasis, without us being aware of it, actually prevents our children from seriously interacting with the scriptures as they're growing, as young people, and they often get into their 20s with a very inadequate base, simply because sometimes I think we've over-promoted the requirements of a secular education. All of these things, those seven things together, and obviously there are others that we can note, but they've had a profound effect on the church, and particularly on the assemblies. And why do I say particularly on the assemblies? See, traditionally the assemblies have relied on their lay leadership to do the evangelism and the preaching and teaching and all the ministry activities of the church. Now, as those last three things, particularly the advent of television, increased leisure activities and extensive education, as those pressures have been placed upon our children, or as they've assumed those pressures, it has significantly crowded out the time available to them to engage in the training and education they need within the church in order that they may function effectively in the ministry capacities that our brethren assemblies need in order to have a significant impact on society. And I think that we need to recognise that a lot of these things that we're now struggling with are a reaction or a response to those things that sometimes we've allowed to subtly come into our world, and we haven't really evaluated them or thought through them. Now, within the new world that emerged from the 60s on, the brethren, like every other religious group, had to make a response to the new world that was emerging. It was no longer sufficient for us to copy old models. If we were to survive like every other religious denomination, we had to face the challenge of revisiting the scriptures and creating new and fresh ministry models that would deal with the culture and society that was emerging. Now, as the charts that I want to put up now indicate, some assemblies rose to that challenge, but sadly, many of them didn't. So now, let me go through the depressing news for you at this point. And can you all see that? I know it's going to be a little bit difficult. If you're struggling to see it, I'm going to move sideways just a whisker so that I don't block the screen here. Now, I trust that you can read it. If you can't, I'll try and give you as much commentary as we go. What we've got here is a slide showing the growth and decline in total numbers of brethren between 1911 and 1996. The data for this is taken from the various censuses that have been conducted across the country through the last century. To make the data points uniform, there's been times when I've had to take a midpoint between censuses to try and make sure that we get a uniform look on the chart. Let me say also that the chart is complicated by two other facts. And that is that, firstly, that both the exclusive and open, brethren are lumped together in the censuses. That's the way it's always been through the censuses, apart from one, which I think was around about, in the 70s, I think, where they separated the two. But otherwise, they've lumped them together, and so that creates a certain cloudiness to the stats. The other problem that complicates this data is that the brethren, to avoid the problem of what we have called sectarianism, have traditionally avoided names like brethren, and sometimes they've commonly used other expressions like the simple, like would respond to the census, like just simply Christian or something like that. There's one little note of hope for us that suggests that the data might be a little more concrete than we might otherwise hope for, and that is a note that was made in AMT, I think around 1911, when the first census was starting to emerge. And the combined elders in Queensland were struggling with how do we answer this census question with regards to the religion. And their ultimate suggestion was, and I think it was a good way of handling it, was they suggested that people should answer it Christian, commonly known as brethren. So if that sort of suggestion was taken nationally, then we may have a more accurate representation up here than we might otherwise have. Anyway, it's only an estimate, obviously, but it's useful in the sense that it gives us a rough idea of the approximate numbers and general trends. Now, the Brethren in Australia started in 1911 with about 8,951 people. That's right down there on the left. We peaked in the 1991 census with 24,136, and we've been inclining in numbers since then to 22,063 in the 96 census. Now, I want to focus momentarily on the 5 years between 91 and 96 to show you how we compared in that period of time to the other religions in Australia. And if you can just put that up for us, Jim. Now, what you've got on this slide here is the growth and decline of the major religions in Australia between 91 and 96. It shows you the percentage of growth or decline in all the major religions. And it's generated, incidentally, by comparing the numbers of people that claim to belong to a certain religion in 91 to those that claim the same in 96. And if you work out the difference between those two, you get a percentage of growth or decline. Now, starting from the left, I've arranged the religions into four groups for you. On the far left, I've got those who claim no religion. It claims in the data, in the census data, it includes those, rather, in the census data who claim to be humanist or materialist. There's been a huge growth in this area since the no religion option was added in 1971. Prior to that, you had to indicate a religion of some kind. In 71, you were given the option of saying no religion. And it's fascinating actually to watch the lines around 71. If you watch the Anglican and the Roman Catholic lines around 71, you watch them do this massive dive in 71, and then they start to pick up after that. But suggesting that a lot of people up until that point in time were just nominally Catholic or Anglican, that's what they were indicating. 71, they had the option to go no religion, and that's what they did. Now, that's been a huge area of growth since 71 until there are now just about 3 million people in Australia who claim to have no religion, or say they have no religion. 3 million out of about 18 million, that's a fairly significant percentage. Now, group two is the non-Christian religions coming across from the left here, and if you look at those, the bars on those charts, you'll see there's been phenomenal growth in the non-Christian religions. Most of that, I think, is probably due to immigration, as people from a lot of the Asian countries have come into the country, they brought their religion with them, and so Hinduism grew over the five-year period, or doubled, or went 54% of growth over the five-year period, but I think most of that's due to immigration. However, I think we need to be very aware of the consequences for our country as we move further and further into a pluralistic society, where it will become increasingly treacherous to argue that Jesus Christ is the only means of salvation. We just need to be sensitive to that as we see this phenomenal growth amongst the non-Christian religions. Now, group three, the next group across, is what I've called, how would you term it? Well, it includes the cults and the Roman Catholic Church. It's those who claim to be a Christian, but we wouldn't necessarily class them as that. Now, I want you just to note the strong growth of the major cults. The Mormons were the fastest growing so-called Christian religion in Australia between 91 and 96. They grew at around 17% in that five-year period. Interestingly, and I was fascinated by this, even the Roman Catholic Church grew around about 4%. Now, if we come across to the group on the far right here, what we have here is the denominations in the Protestant evangelical tradition of which we're a part. Out of the 9 Protestant evangelical denominations over that period, only 3 grew. Now, 3 that grew were the Pentecostals, the Baptists, and the Salvation Army. Pentecostals were the fastest growing denomination at 16.02%. But interestingly, their growth is slowing rapidly, and it's fairly freely acknowledged now that the back door for the Pentecostals is almost as big as the front door. And I think the National Church Life Survey suggested that about a third of the people that enter Pentecostal churches are exiting it. They're losing about a third continually as they go. Be that as it may, they were still growing faster than any other denomination for that period of time. The sobering fact for us is, as you look at that chart, that the serious fact for us really is that we were the fastest declining denomination. Now, we lost over that 5-year period around 8.58% of our people. Now, that represents a loss in actual terms of around about 2,000, the 2,000 that exited the Brethren over the 5-year period for various reasons. Once again, the figure is complicated by virtue of the fact that both the exclusives and open are lumped together. However, I'm personally inclined to think that the exclusives have probably held their own, and I say that for several reasons. Firstly, the cultic nature of the exclusives now, just that very fact creates a degree of conformity to the church that is very, very powerful, creates a very strong hold on people. We experience that as a family. And the belief that there's no salvation to be found outside of the group keeps people within it, even when they're only in it for token reason. But nevertheless, I think that they're holding their own possibly for that, but also secondly because of their propensity to have big families. Right. Now, I'm the oldest of 7, and that wasn't unusual in the exclusives. You know, 5, 6 kids was a fairly normal family. And, I mean, I won't go into that. If you haven't got any TV or any entertainment, well. But anyway, they have big families. And I think that for that reason, the exclusives have probably held their own. Now, if that assumption is right, then the figures are much more damaging for ourselves than they appear on the surface. I did some work recently on trying to get an understanding of the average assembly size, and I would estimate that probably the average assembly size across the nation would be between 50 and 60 people. That's right? Yeah, well, that's encouraging. If you average that across, or if you multiply that by the number of assemblies that we have in the country, that would end up giving us around 13,000 to 14,000 people that would be classed as open brethren or Christian brethren. Now, that means if I'm right and the exclusives have held their own, that means that 2,000 loss is coming straight off the top of our 13,000 to 14,000, which means that our decline rate is really much higher than 8.58%. It's probably closer to about 15%. Right? 15% over a 5-year period. Now, evidence for that sort of decline receives additional credibility if we compare the growth and decline in numbers of Christian brethren assemblies across the centuries. So we're moving now from numbers of people to numbers of assemblies. So Jim, if you can just put that slide up for us. What you have here is the number of assemblies from 1901 to 1999. The data for this came from two sources primarily. Ken Newton's doctoral thesis called The History of the Brethren in Australia. How many of you have seen that document? Yeah, grab it. It's an invaluable little commentary for us on the history of the brethren in this country. I've got a copy over there if you want to have a look at it. If you want to get a copy, just because Ken's the principal of the Queensland Bible College, you just write there and they'll send you a copy. An invaluable little resource that we all should have. Now, that's one source from which that I drew the data for this chart, and the other was the comparison of the list of meetings in AMC. And I was thrilled to discover when you go back into Tidings and the Tidings office that they've got all the AMCs that go right back into the late 1800s, and that the list of meetings appears from around about 1910, like a track. A little bit hazy in those earlier years, but nevertheless, by putting those two things together, I was able to come up with this approximations of what the assemblies, in terms of numbers, what the assemblies look like over the last century. I stress that they're approximations because many don't list with AMC, we all know that, and so that makes the data a little bit cloudy, but nevertheless I think they're fairly close to the mark. We started last century with 47 assemblies, we grew until we peaked and plateaued between 71 and 81 with around 300 assemblies. That was the high point in our growth, and we then began to decline. The decline was slow in the first 10 years, but then it began to accelerate. Between 1981 and 1991, in that 10-year period, we lost 8 assemblies. However, the slide gets much worse in the next 8 years. Between 91 and 99, we lost 25 assemblies, which is around 3 a year. That's bad, but I fear potentially, and I'll come back to explain this, the worst is yet to come for us as a movement. Now the next thing I ask myself is, how does the growth in the number of assemblies compare to the growth in the Australian population? In other words, how have we done keeping up with the population growth of Australia? And that's the next slide that we'll put up here, and this is the number of assemblies per million people. Now if you look at that chart, you'll see that we started the century with 12.4 assemblies per million Australians. Okay, 12.4 assemblies for every million Australians. We grew faster than the population to 1951, where we had 27.67 assemblies per million people. We then lost touch with the population increase, and we've declined until we're now down to around 14.06 assemblies per million people. So we're actually getting close to where we were at the beginning of the century. I then asked myself, well, are there social or cultural factors that may have contributed to the decline? In other words, how had other denominations gone in terms of growth? Have they shown the same pattern as we've got up here? So what I did was go back and research a few of the other denominations, and I've chosen to put up the Baptists for you because of their similarity in a lot of ways to ourselves. So what you've got on the next slide is the number of assemblies and Baptist fellowships per million people. Now, from the chart, you'll notice that the Baptists have essentially kept pace with the population growth. They started with about 52.5 fellowships per million people in 1901. They ran up to about 64 fellowships in 1911. They dropped a bit in 1981 to 47. And it's interesting, if you look at the chart, they, like ourselves, show a fall between 61 and 81, remembering 61 is a significant point. They show a fall between 61 and 81, but where we've continued to fall, they've been able to stabilise things, and the line is now gradually going up. You notice that you can just see the drop there, 61 to 81, but now they're stabilised and they're slowly heading up again. Now the average across the century has been around about 53 fellowships per million people. That's what they've averaged. So what that suggests is, by and large, they've kept the line fairly flat as the population of Australia has gone up. They've managed to plant Baptist churches and fellowships that have kept up with the population growth, so that they're maintaining around about 50 fellowships per million people. Now that does not say that there might have been not have been social and cultural factors involved, but what it does indicate is that the Baptists did a better job of coping with them than we did ourselves. And I want to show you that same data from a slightly different angle, and we'll put up the next one there for you, which is the number of assemblies and Baptist fellowships. This is just the pure numbers of assemblies and Baptist fellowships across the last century. Now I want you to watch this one closely because this is about the only good news in the chart that I'm putting up, and I want to draw your attention to that as we go. Now, in terms of numbers of fellowships, both were growing rapidly in the first half of the century. However, where we plateaued and began to decline in 71, the Baptists kept going. Obviously, they made the transition through those difficult years much more effectively than we actually did. Now, let me give you the note of hope, and I think it's important that we pick this one up because it's important for it. Let me just come down here to do that. Over here in 1901, you'll notice that we had 47 assemblies, essentially, and the Baptists had around 190, let's round it out, 200 Baptist fellowships. That was the beginning of the 1900s. By the time we get to 1951, we've got 233 assemblies to 504 Baptist fellowships. And you know the significance of that? We started with about a quarter of what they had. By 51, we'd halved that. We were almost caught up. We'd almost made about, we always represent about 50% of what they had. So what that suggests to me anyway is that there was a dynamic quality to what the brethren were doing in those first 50 years that meant if we'd kept at that rate, essentially we would have caught up with the Baptists probably by about now in terms of numbers of fellowships. But we didn't. We lost touch and we've been falling away since then. Now I said before that while we'd lost 25 assemblies between 91 and 99, that I feared the worst is yet to come. And the reason I say that is over the last 18 months, we've tried to get a feeling for what we may see potentially as losses of the assembly movement over the next 10 to 15 years. And what we've done is we've spoken to a number of individuals across the various states of this country, and in the next 20 years, if nothing changes, this is what we'll probably see, alright? The next 20 years, if nothing changes, this is what we'll probably see. You can just put that slide up, Jim. If nothing changes, we estimate that in the next 20 years, and we think we've been conservative, we'll see the further loss of around 75 assemblies, which is around about 37 every 10 years. And since we put this data together, we've been tracking it a little bit, and it looks like we're pretty close to the mark in terms of what we've seen over the last 2 years anyway. Now, how did we arrive at that figure? Because obviously that's a question that you want to ask. Well, this is the formula that we used. We went back to all those different people across the country and we said, how many of the congregations or how many assemblies are you aware of in this country to fall into this category? There are a small assembly where at least 80% of the congregation is 60 plus. There's very few, if any, young families in the assembly. And to your knowledge of the assembly, you anticipate no future change. How many assemblies that you're aware of fit into that category? And they came back to us and we coded all those up, and that's around about the 75 assemblies mark. Now, what's the logic in that? Well, see, the reality is if you put 15 to 20 years on a congregation that is mainly 60 plus, then in 10 to 15 years, then you'll have nobody to keep the doors open. Whether we like it or not, folks, they're going home to glory. And the chapel will probably become home for another denomination, or we're still a pizza or a pancake parlor or something like that. Alright. I don't know if that hits you, but every time I go past the church or it's been converted to one of those things, I moan. Why should that be? But that's reality, you know. If we've got congregations that are like that, then it's impossible to sustain that. As you put another 10 to 15 years on those people. In terms of numbers of assemblies per million people, this will probably what it'll look like. What you have here is the numbers of assemblies per million people, including the possible decline in the next 20 years. Now, if you look at that, we started the century with around 12.4 assemblies per million people. If we keep going on the trend we're at, by 2021, we estimate we're probably down to around about 8 assemblies per million people. Let me just say to you, that if that trend that we're seeing continues, we face a future as a movement that will almost be totally irrelevant to Australian life and culture and to the Australian church. And it's not, let me say to you, it's not a problem with being brethren, for in many parts of the world, the assemblies are multiplying at an explosive rate. South Korea is a good example of that. So it's really a problem that we have, and that's a problem we have here. I'd be interested to know what it's like in the UK and America, but I suspect they may have similar problems to what we've got. So the end result of all that is that sort of data should really humble us. I mean, it's depressing, but it also should humble us. It should really make us fall on our faces before the Lord and ask, why? Why has it come to this? Why is it that a movement of God's people, which has such a rich and biblical heritage, has come to the point where it's declining faster than any other religious denomination in this country? I've only got this on anecdotal evidence that someone said it to me. I'd love to get it in written form. But they said that Spurgeon was rumoured to have said with regard to the brethren, if they'd continued the way they began, they would have turned the world upside down. Right? That was our roots. That was our roots, brothers. And I asked the question, why is it that we've come to this state? Why is it that the purveyors of a false gospel like the Mormons can grow at around 70% over 5 years, and in the same period we go backwards by at least 8.58%, if not closer to 15%? Why is it? And I've just turned 40, and that's really a question to those of you that are older than 40, those of you that have seen years that I haven't seen in the assembly. My question really to you is to ask you, from your understanding of the movement in this country, why is it that way? And I think that's a question that we've got to be continually asking ourselves at the moment. Because if we are to have a future, and if our young people are to have a future, we've got to start to learn the lessons of the past in order that we don't repeat them in the future. It's a question that's been really on my mind now for about 18 months since I put all these stats together, and I'd be really keen to hear from any of you who might have some insight into why you think it is this way. Why is it that we've got to this state? And what lessons are there we can learn from our past in order that we can make, in a sense, a difference in the future? I want to come back now and just, in our remaining time that we've got left, just think through what may be some of the reasons for why we are where we are. Over the last 3 years, just through travelling, I've had the opportunity and privilege really of moving into a number of assemblies across the country, and I've been observing changes that are being made and things that are being tried. One of the things that I've noticed, which is an interesting phenomenon, is that many assemblies are trying all sorts of different programs that are coming out of, particularly out of the US, out of the church growth movement. And so many assemblies are bringing in a lot of the stuff that's coming out of Willow Creek and Saddleback and all the rest of it. And I think a lot of the material that's coming out of those churches is tremendous. And I think that God has used those churches internationally and powerfully to teach the church some major lessons that it needs to learn. But one thing I am noticing is that as many assemblies try these different programs, they're running into a number of different problems. Let me draw this out a little bit for you. I'm seeing many assemblies that will pick up one of the Saddleback programs, for instance, and they'll introduce into the life of the church, and they'll do that with a lot of gusto and a lot of enthusiasm, so they'll bring in all the materials that Eric Warren has written, etc., and they'll plug them into the church, and then 12 months, 2 years later, they'll be standing back, and the elders are scratching their head saying, I just cannot understand it. It just didn't work for us like it was meant to work, like it worked for Rick Warren. And so then commonly, what they will often do is say, well, there must be a better program around, so they grab another one that's coming into vogue, they plug that into the church, and then repeat the whole cycle again, because 12 months later they're still scratching their head and wondering why it didn't work the way it was meant to work. Don't get me wrong, I'm not having a go at programs. I think programs are absolutely critical to a church. But what I would argue is that so many of those things cannot be duplicated, that often a lot of that stuff is just simply something that God has uniquely done in a unique church, in a unique situation, with a unique leadership that has capacity to guide those whole things. And a lot of these things can't be just simply exported and have the same results they had back where they originated from. The problem is that as assemblies repeat that cycle, is that increasingly the believers or the congregation gets more and more cynical and jaded. And after a while they start to say, well, what's the next program the elders are going to lump upon us that's going to turn out to be a huge fizzer? And so their enthusiasm for the different programs just dwindles and dwindles as time goes by. Now, as I said before, don't get me wrong, I'm a believer in programs, but what I would argue is that programs come and programs go, but ultimately there must be a deeper and more fundamental key that is necessary for church growth to occur strategically and over an extended period of time. What I want to do is do a little exercise with you that I've been doing often in situations that actually is quite helpful. And this little exercise, I want to abbreviate it now for the sake of time. But just stop for a minute. And this is a question I want you to answer in your own mind. Right? Just think through this question, and then we'll just take some quick responses after you've had 30 seconds to reflect on it. What do you think is the key to church growth? That's the question. What is the key to church growth? Now, some of you have been involved in this already, and so I just ask you to just be a little quiet at this point because you know the answer that we want to drive at. But for those of you that haven't been involved in that exercise before, just think on that question for a little while. What is the key to church growth? Often the first response is normally the best one. Let's just take them straight off the top. Any suggestions what they think the key to church growth is? I like that. Plugging into God, not a program. Compassion for souls and plugging into God. Bible-based teaching. Now, that's an interesting development you just made on the point, because your point initially started with having people who had a passion for souls, and you expanded that out to having a leadership that was likewise impassioned that way. Okay, good. Let me just, it'd be nice if we had a little bit of time, we could continue this conversation and dialogue a little further. Let me just bring it to a close in this way. And someone has alerted to us, someone this other end of the board. You notice the question was, what is the key to church growth? And what we've actually done is we've produced, in a sense, a lot of keys to church growth. And the reason we've done that is we're recognising there's a lot of things that need to be in place if the church is to grow. And we struggle with that tension. We say, we've got to have strategies to reach the lost. Yeah, we've got to have teaching and systematic expository teaching. All right, we've got to develop believers so they're mature and stable. And so we struggle with that tension. I want to suggest to you that, and I'm becoming more and more convinced of this principle, and you mightn't like it, but at least think about it. I'm going to suggest to you that the key, if there is a key to church growth, the key to church growth is good leadership. Alright? Now let me explain why I'm arguing that point. If you've got good, and I better clarify that, when I say good leadership, I'm capturing under that adjective all the qualities that the scriptures talk about that should be in place in a spiritual leader. And so he should meet the qualifications of an elder. And so on and so on. So that's what I'm meaning by good leadership. Godly leadership, if you want to put it that way, but good leadership. Now, why am I arguing that? What I would argue is if you've got good leadership in place in an assembly, that leadership will be ensuring that the church has strategies for reaching the lost. That leadership will be ensuring that there is discipleship taking place, there is teaching that is effective and bearing fruit. It will be ensuring, which is interesting, it will be ensuring that prayer is taking place, which is one thing that didn't come up. But you get my point. What I'm saying is that you can take all those things that you suggested, and if you've got good leadership in place, then that is probably the more fundamental key, because it will be that godly, good leadership that will ensure that all the other activities are in place in order that the church may grow. And so if there is a more fundamental key that underlies it all, I would argue it's the question or the answer of good leadership. Now, I should qualify that by saying that I'm assuming in that statement, I'm assuming the given, that ultimately it's the Spirit that builds the church. It's the very fact that Jesus said he would build his church and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. It's that very fact that means the church does grow. So I'm assuming that as a given. But what I'm arguing is, when the Lord...
Would you please turn the tape over at this point?
What I'm arguing is, when the Lord orchestrates that growth, I believe that that growth comes through the emergence of good leadership that he raises up to lead a congregation in such a way that they're effective and healthy. What I'm really arguing is that there is an indissoluble link between the health or growth of an institution and the quality of its leadership. That's what I'm arguing. Health and growth appear to be the fruit of good leadership, weakness and decline that of poor or inadequate administration or leadership. John Maxwell, and I'm not a real fan of John Maxwell because I worry about a lot of the stuff that he's bringing into the church under the name of Christian, but he makes some good points occasionally, and this is one of the ones that I like. Maxwell calls this the law of the lid. He says, leadership ability is always the lid on personal and organisational effectiveness. If the leadership is strong, the lid is high. But if it's not, then the organisation is limited. In other words, what he's saying is that no church rises above or ever outgrows the breadth and depth of its leadership. That's fact. Now, you might object to that and say, well, can't God work apart from that? Well, of course he can, but it appears, as I read my Bible, that he chooses not to do so. Now, why do I say that? You read through the Old Testament, and you'll note this over and over again. When God's people are in need, what does God do? Well, he raises up a leader or leaders that he can use to turn the people back to himself. In Ezekiel's terminology, he looks for a man who will stand in the gap, a gap man or a gap woman. Repeatedly, Scripture links the health and well-being of God's people with its leadership. You think through the book of Judges in this regard. Remember the pattern that emerges out of the book of Judges. The people sin, God judges them by placing them in bondage to another nation. Eventually, in the midst of that servitude, the people cry out to God in repentance and request for salvation. God responds and sends that salvation. And you tell me from your knowledge of the book of Judges, how does that salvation come? How does that salvation come? Comes through a man. Comes through a judge that God raises up to deliver his people. If you think through the same issue with regard to the kings of Israel, what happens when a good king is on the throne? Well, then generally you have a time of peace and prosperity and spiritual well-being for the people. When there's a bad king on the throne, then generally there's a time of unrest and spiritual decline. Now, I'm talking in terms of I'm making general statements here. I mean, they're not absolute, but I'm arguing that I think this is a principle that is repeated over and over again in the Old Testament, and that we need to take note of it. Now let me make another statement that builds on the first, and this is it. The first statement was that good leadership is the key to growth. Here's the second one. I believe that continual leadership development across all levels is the key to sustained growth. Alright? Continual leadership development across all levels is the key to sustained growth. Listen to me carefully. Without a continually replenished leadership, any assembly will struggle to maintain its ministry. But without a continually developing one, it can never hope to expand them. You see, leadership is the key to the success of any ministry. You look behind any fruitful ministry and you know what you'll find? You'll find a good leader or leaders. Successful ministries just don't happen. They're the fruit of good leadership and a lot of hard work. And it's that hard work element that means without a continually replenished leadership, a church or an assembly will struggle to maintain its ministry. See, people get tired unless the leadership in that ministry is continually replenished, then eventually it will lose momentum or fold for a lack of people to drive it. See, an assembly needs to be continually replenishing its leaders if it's going to maintain its ministries, but it can never hope to develop them unless it's continually developing leaders. And that's why I say to you that continual leadership development is the key to sustained growth. Putting it another way, leadership potential is growth potential. You multiply your evangelists, and if God blesses their efforts, then you'll multiply, by and large, your conversions. you multiply your shepherds and your pastors, then you'll multiply your capacity to care for those converts. If you multiply your teachers, then you'll multiply your capacity to make those converts into established believers. You multiply your established believers and you'll multiply the pool from which you can draw your potential leaders in order to start the cycle all over again. That's all that I'm really arguing at that point. I've got to go back now to an illustration from AFL football, which is a bit unfortunate, but I'm a supporter or a fan of the Essendon Football Club. They're the ones with the black shirts and the red stripe, you know, the ones that have been ripped. The Bombers. Is that how you know them? The Bombers? Yeah. Now, for Bombers, Bomber fans, the last 10 years has been a pretty good 10 years. But I can remember in the 80s, there was a time when the club was struggling. But there was something in the midst of that that really encouraged us as Bomber supporters. And I'll tell you what it was the fact that our seconds started to win. And I can remember going to a game and watching a young man by the name of Paul Salmon, who was a monster of a guy, emerging in the seconds, and as we were watching this young guy play, we're saying, there's a man of the future, there's a player of the future. And sure enough, he realised his potential, went through to the first, and he helped Essendon win a lot of flags. You see, all I'm doing is illustrating that point. You see, if you've got leadership potential there, then you've got growth potential. Put it another way, if you're going to have a good Sunday school, what are you going to need to have? You tell me, what are you going to need to have if you're going to have a good Sunday school? Good Sunday school teachers, alright? If you're going to have an effective pastoral ministry that really does care for the flock, what are you going to need to have? Good pastors. Alright, now we could just go on making that same point over and over again, but I hope you get the point, and that is I'm convinced more and more that the key to sustained growth is the continual development of leadership. And it's only as an assembly multiplies its trained leadership that it will multiply its growth. At this point I'm going to put in a little bit of a plug for CBTE, and that'll be the limit of it. At the heart of what we're doing with CBTE is the belief that we've got to get back to the fundamental key of each local church essentially seeing itself as a training institution devoted to the development of every believer across a lifelong learning process and the development internally within of its next crop of leadership that it will need to draw on in order to continue its growth platform. And beyond that, as it develops more leaders that can be then taken out of their fellowship to plant others and to do the work of mission, etc., etc. One of the problems that we've had as a movement, and it's interesting someone came up and spoke to me about this during the short break we had, one of the problems we've had as a movement is the continual hemorrhage over the last 15 years of some of the best and brightest of our young people. And I'll tell you, I went through the theological colleges and I'll tell you what happens in that situation. You get some good young bredo, and you send him in one of the Bible colleges because he desperately wants some training to make him effective for the Lord. He gets into the midst of that college situation and he starts to hear of what his Baptist friends are going to go into as a result of the end of their training. You know, they're talking about at exiting they're going to get a $40,000 job plus a car and a house and all the rest of it thrown in. And after a while, they start to ask themselves, well, what am I going to go back to? Probably the ministry that I was engaged in before I left will probably have been taken by somebody else. Oh, I'm not really sure of that. But what will I go back to? Maybe Sunday school teaching? Now, you get my point. What we're arguing with CBTE is we're arguing that the local church is the most effective platform from which to develop its potential leaders. And sadly, one of the things that I'm starting to see in the assemblies, which is really distressing really, is that some of the bigger assemblies, more progressive assemblies that we're seeing across the country are starting, in a sense, to rob some of the smaller assemblies of some of their best. I know of one assembly in Queensland just recently, and it sucked out of another assembly in another part of the country, two of its potential leaders, and it's brought them in and offered them a fairly good package. You know, and this is happening continually where a lot of the time some of our best young people are not only transferring out of the movement, but also transferring to some of the bigger, more progressive churches. Now, I understand why that is, because they're going to a situation where there's vision and good leadership. All right? We can't escape that fact. But ultimately, what I am saying is that it's a far more appropriate situation if each local church starts to see its responsibilities of developing its own leadership and not robbing them from other places, because we can't afford that to occur. So that's at the heart of CBTE, the belief that each local church has to really see itself as a training institution devoted to the development of believers and leaders within in a very serious and ordered way. How are we going? Can I extend you for 5 more minutes just to finish this off? Do you mind? Let me just make one other point, and I think it's one of the lessons that we need to learn from our history. I'm convinced, in a sense, that as we develop leaders, we need to develop them in a situation where all the generations are growing and developing together. And what I'm going to argue beyond that point is I believe very strongly now that each generation has to rediscover the biblical truth for themselves. I'm convinced of that. That each emerging generation has to rediscover the biblical truth for themselves. I'm persuaded that one of the reasons we've struggled as a movement to cope with the changes that occurred from the 1960s on is that by and large our congregations did not go back to rediscover the biblical truths afresh and then apply them in a fresh and new way to the culture that was emerging. Some did, but some didn't. And this resulted to a degree, I'm generalising here, this resulted to a degree in a polarising of assemblies into basically two camps. There's what I will call the progressives and what I'd call the conservatives. And once again, forgive me if I'm stepping on toes as I go here, but I think this is the best way to illustrate the point. By and large, what happened was the conservatives despised the progressives because while they, progressives may have become culturally relevant, in so doing, they said that they'd become biblically unsound. And thus, for example, they condemned the progressives for their modern services, upbeat music, etc., etc. And what the conservatives argued was, this is actually letting the world into church. Now, the progressives, on the other hand, despise the conservatives because while they may have been biblically sound, and I put that in inverted commas, they were clearly culturally irrelevant. Thus, for example, the progressives condemned the conservatives for their irrelevant services like the gospel meeting and the usage of dull hymns, etc., etc. And what they argued was this is maintaining traditions that were irrelevant and unbiblical or didn't have a biblical standpoint. Now, let's imagine for a moment that there was an element of truth in both accusations, that the progressives were going too far and were letting the world into the church. The conservatives, on the other hand, were holding on to sacred yet unbiblical traditions. Now, what is the problem in both those cases? Well, this is what I think it was, is that both parties had failed to go back to rediscover the biblical truth for themselves. The progressives had uncritically adopted worldly standards and values because they had not first relayed the biblical foundation in their own minds, so they critically discerned between those things that were biblical and those things that weren't. The conservatives, on the other hand, had also failed to go back to rediscover the biblical truth for themselves, and so they were failing to distinguish between those things that were biblical and thus immovable and those things that were traditions of men and thus dispensable in a different and emerging culture. My point is that unless each generation rediscovers the truth for itself, it runs the risk of becoming either irrelevant or worldly. Let me make another point. I really do believe that it's only to a degree, I believe that it's only those that are in a generation that truly understand it. You get me? Those that are in a generation that truly understand it. For that reason, they'll be the most effective at reaching that generation for Jesus Christ. Because they truly understand that generation. I've just turned 40. I just had my 40th birthday a week or so ago. And as I said before, I'm the oldest of 7 children, and my mum and dad had 6 kids. And then after my younger sister was born, about 10 years later, they had a gift from God. And his was a son. My youngest brother, Ben, is 21 years of age, so there's a 19-year gap between Ben and myself. Now, I love my brother, but I've got to tell you something. I don't understand him. I really don't. I don't understand his taste in music. I don't understand a lot of his values, a lot of the way he relates to his friends, etc., etc. And what I'm arguing is that my brother Ben will be much more successful, in a sense, at reaching his generation for Jesus Christ than I ever will be. Because he understands that generation. But the problem for Ben is, unless he relays the biblical foundation for himself, he's at risk of either being irrelevant or becoming worldly. One of the tremendously exciting things that we're beginning to see in assemblies as they get involved in some of the various CBT courses is that the generations together are going back to rediscover the biblical truth for themselves in a serious and systematic way. They're forced into that by the construct of the material. And the changes that are starting to emerge out of that are quite significant. And it's particularly true when you see an older eldership team include their next generation of leadership in their groups. And what's happening is, as we're starting to see it emerge, is that together the generations are rediscovering the biblical truth and learning to apply it in a given situation. And what happens is mutual trust and respect develops across the generation. Generation gap starts to break down and the assembly begins to become both biblical and relevant. For goodness sake, folks, you know, the world can't hold generations together, but the church should surely be able to do that. And it's an indictment upon us when we can't get generations working together. And it's also not an indictment upon us, but it's also sapping our lifeblood, because unless we get the generations connected, we're not going to ensure the perpetuity of leadership that we need to keep the church on a growth platform. Just recently I was in an assembly, I'm just going to finish with two illustrations now. Just recently I was in an assembly for a period of time, and on several occasions had an opportunity to speak to both the key young people and the elders. And on both occasions, the meeting that came up under discussion was the evening meeting. The young people's complaint about the evening meeting was that it was irrelevant and boring. And what was beginning to happen was they were beginning one by one to boycott that evening meeting and go to the local Baptist church instead. Interestingly, the elders' complaint about the young people was that all they wanted in the evening meeting was entertainment. And there was no way they were going to entertain in the evening meeting. The question is that really what the younger people wanted? Was it really entertainment, or was it biblical relevance? I don't know. But I know one thing's for sure, unless the two groups sit down together and talk about it, you're never really going to know. And the result for that assembly at the moment is, sadly, is that both sides are hanging on to the positions. The elders because they think their position is biblical. Well, the young people, they're not so sure whether their position is biblical, but one thing they are sure of, unless something changes, they're out of there. They're out of there. Now, commonly what occurs in that situation is that, you know, if that situation endures, is increasingly the young people become disenchanted. And eventually they decide, well, it's not worth banging my head against the wall anymore, and they just leave. Often without realizing why they're leaving, but just leaving. Now let me say to you, as each one leaves, it becomes increasingly difficult for that assembly to retain and attract young people. Because whether we like it or not, folks, young people want to be where young people are. And once young people's critical mass in an assembly falls below a certain level, it becomes almost impossible to re-attract young people to that assembly. Alright? It's increasingly difficult. And sadly for that assembly, unless something special from the Lord occurs, I think we'll see a repeat of what we're seeing continually across this country, where the young people slowly and sometimes rapidly exit that assembly, leaving that assembly in the situation I was describing before, where 80% of the congregation is 60 plus, no young people, etc., etc. And folks, whether we like it or not, the only foreseeable future then for that assembly is someone to close the door after the last person signed to be with the Lord. That's why, when that scenario is repeated. Let me give you a positive example, and this one's an exciting one. This is one I'll finish with. Another assembly that went through a particularly painful experience about 2 years ago, where there was a difficulty within the assembly that really sent the assembly into a state of disarray. And I was talking to the elders there, and I suggested to them, well, look, why don't you bring your whole eldership together, because they had to redevelop vision for the assembly, bring your whole eldership together, and also the potential young leaders that have been causing problems, but you know are your future, bring them all together and study through the book of Acts and rediscover, in a sense, God's vision for your church. You know, just don't try and inherit somebody else's, which is commonly what we're seeing, but discover what God wants to make uniquely in your situation and take the scriptures as your starting point and work from there and see what God might share with you. So that's what they did. They brought the elders and the young, potential young leaders together, and they studied through the book of Acts, and they went on to the next course, which is the Pauline Epistles course, and now they're moving into a third course. I was talking to the facilitator of that group a couple of months ago now, and he said something that really, really thrilled me. He said, Tim, you know, I'm now 55 years of age. And he says, as a result of our studies, I've realized in the next 10 years, I've got to work myself out of a job. And he said, you know what? For the first time, I feel comfortable and confident about leaving that job to the younger generation that's coming after me. Now, why was that? Why was that? It's because they'd spent 2 years together hammering out a consensus concerning the truth, working through the Word of God, and studying it together. And what was happening is the younger ones were helping the older ones to understand the culture that they were going to have to deal with, and the older ones were helping to keep the younger ones on track because of their biblical background and knowledge. And together, they developed the unity that was really important for that particular assembly. You know, before what was happening commonly is the young ones are standing on the outside of the eldership and all they're doing is heaving rocks in, you know? We gotta get some change around here. So, woof, in goes that rock. Well, get another, and woof, in goes another rock. And all the elders are doing is standing there with shields trying to protect themselves and the rocks that are coming in. Alright? And that's commonly what we see happening. Well, the answer to that, I'm convinced more and more, is to get the generations together to study through the Word of God together. And out of that now, the young ones are then in that assembly driving the changes that the elders are coming up with. And that's the exciting thing for that particular assembly. Now, there's a lot more that we could say. Let me just close by making this little point. I really think that if we have a future as a movement, that it's going to take a lot of hard work and, in a sense, a lot of pain. But I think a lot of change will have to occur in order to have a foreseeable future. But I think that pain is inevitable and we've got to really take it and accept it as our lot as a movement if we're going to go forward from here. I've got a tiny little daughter at home. She's my second child and she was tiny from birth and she's still tiny now. And about 2 months ago we took her into the hospital and discovered that she, like other children, the pituitary gland is not excreting enough growth hormone. And so what they mean is that she's very, very small for her age. And what they suggested to us, they said, look, the only way we can help her to maybe get a little bit of extra height before she hits puberty is to give her growth hormone. And that growth hormone is in the form of an injection. And so we talked about it with her for a month or so. She's petrified of injections. Eventually she got the courage and said, yeah, I'll go for it. Well, 4 days ago we started. And I gotta tell you, that needle looks massive, and I know it's only fine, but it looks huge. And we spent an hour with that nurse in that hospital trying to convince her to take the first injection. Because she was petrified of that thing. We finally got her to take it, we got back home and think, whew, that's the first one out of the way. The second one took us 2 hours. I thought we were going downhill from here, we're actually going uphill. The third one, we almost had to hold her down to get it in. And the fourth one last night, I think we got a bit of a victory. But you know what the problem is that little girl is petrified of the anticipated pain that comes with that needle. And I've got to tell you that as she sits there on the couch and shakes uncontrollably when I say to her, honey, you've got to take the needle. She says, no, Daddy, I don't want to take my needle. And as we basically in the end have to hold her down, and I have to put that needle in her leg, you know, my heart aches. I don't do that to her. But it's something that has to be done if she's to grow. And what I want to suggest to you is that there's something that we have to do to grow. And we're going to do it if we can have a future. So we just pray. Father, we thank you for your grace and mercy. We thank you for your patience and long suffering. Come to you tonight, Father, acknowledging that we're in a state where we're not very happy about. We're looking to you in grace and mercy to work with us in helping us to make a difference in this next generation that's emerging. Father, we know that we're going to need a lot of help in order to do that, and we just ask you tonight to give us that help. We ask this in Jesus' name. Amen. Mm-hmm.